am Dr. Patricia Grabarek.
And I'm Dr. Katina Sawyer. And welcome to Thriving at Work, a Worker Being podcast.
You can learn more about us on our website, workerbeing.com, or on social media. Plus, we talked about our book last time, and we're super excited in the writing process right now. And if you want to learn more about our book, hear about our journey, and get the first updates as we share with folks, sign up for our email list. You will find the link in our show notes, as well as a link to get our top tips for workplace wellness. It's a great little downloadable, so feel free to check that out.
So today we are going to be talking about how allyship can go wrong, which is a topic we've talked a little bit about how to be an ally before, and it's not necessarily like a doom and gloom, but it's just something to keep in mind, something that might be good for folks to know, and then also what you can do about it. So there's a little bit of a solution that we also provide there. But before we get into that, I was going to ask a question, which is, have you ever seen allyship go wrong in the wild?
So it's a really good question. I don't have anything off the top of my head that I can speak to, like a specific example, but I've definitely seen situations where I think people from the majority group will jump in to defend or redirect towards a person of a minority group. But I've seen the faces of those people where it seemed annoyed, maybe they were going to jump in themselves, but I can't think of pinpoint one specific example, but I know I've definitely seen it.
Yeah, it is a tough question to get asked on the fly, so I understand that. I was thinking about a particular instance that I saw, and obviously I had time to think about this ahead of time, but I was thinking about an instance that I saw where a student of mine who was in one of my DEI classes and another student of mine who was also in the same class, he is gay, but he was out in the class kind of selectively. I wouldn't say he was closeted in the class, but he was, he would talk about it with some students in the class. So I guess some of the students could have assumed that he might be out on campus, but he never made that clear. And she was kind of another student in my class. She was kind of a few folks behind him in the cafeteria line. And then I was a few folks behind both of them. And there were guys standing in between her and him who were loudly making jokes, and they were using homophobic slurs in their jokes. And, I think she was feeling kind of emboldened from taking this class and thinking about inequities. And we had talked a little bit about allyship, that she felt we've been talking about showing courage in moments where it matters. I'm going to step in. I'm going to be the person that's going to say something. And so she called the boys out and said, hey, I heard what you're saying. I don't appreciate it. And they were like, it's just a joke, whatever. And she said, well, you never know who could be listening. In fact, did you know there's a gay person standing right in front of you? And the boy from my class went all red and got really embarrassed and upset. And, obviously she had outed him in front of these people, but it was a moment where he had sort of wanted to say something himself and didn't, and chose not to say something for whatever reason. Did not really appreciate that she called him out or pulled him into it. He might have appreciated it if she had just called it out without pulling him into it. But so that's an example that kind of came to mind. And it actually doesn't have a lot to do with the findings today, but I was a witness to it. And so as a witness to that allyship, that's what we're going to kind of be talking about.
That's really sad. I mean, it makes a lot of sense why she did what she did and how she felt like she was making an impact and a difference. But yeah, at some point you don't bring in the other person, because that also makes it really weird. What if they were not apologetic or mean or whatever? It could have gone really, really badly, versus just someone saying, hey, I don't like you saying that, it's really rude and whatever. Then they can address that situation. But if they actually held these beliefs and now you're pointing to somebody that they could react to, it could create an even more negative situation too. So there's the outing component, but there's also a potential for a threat. I don't know. Who knows what's going to happen in that situation. So that's really unfortunate. I'm sure she learned from that experience. But I am curious to hear more about your paper, though, and I'm really excited that we're doing a paper of yours.
Yeah, I'm excited too. So this paper has been in the works for a few years, so it's exciting to see it come out. And I wrote it with my colleagues Christian Thorogood and Tony Kong and Jenica Webster. And what we are looking at here is a little bit of a different angle. So in the story that I had shared, this was an act of allyship that went wrong for the target of that allyship themselves. Like, I'm standing up for you or people like you, and it didn't go the way the person wanted. But there's another element to allyship that I think people who want to be allies or who are allies assume is true, which is that allyship is going to inspire other people to also stand up for what they believe in. And while that can be true, we're going to talk about that there are some nuances to what happens when people witness allyship from people in their own group. So a couple of things about terms. I'm going to be talking about allyship, but specifically in this study, I'm going to be talking about a particular form of allyship called oppositional courage, which is basically the idea that you have to stand in opposition to a status quo, and it has to be risky in some way. So there are lots of ways people can show allyship. You might sign a petition in your workplace saying that you support an anti-harassment policy or something. But if every single person in your office agrees that it's really important to have that anti-harassment policy, and you're one signature on that list of hundreds of signatures, that might not count as an act of courage, right? Because you're sort of standing with the crowd and you've all decided that something would be good to maybe protect people from the one or two people who may not be creating an inclusive environment. Oppositional courage really happens when you see something that happens that's unjust, or there's a norm for exclusivity, and you are a person who wants to stand in opposition to that. So it's particularly risky, and in other papers we have shown that this particularly risky form of courage is actually extra important for sending messages of value to people in the population, because if you're willing to take a risk for them, it means you must really care about them. And so we're looking at how witnessing acts of oppositional courage in support of social justice for a group that you're not a part of, from someone who's also in the same group as you. So in this particular study, we're looking at white people standing up for racial justice. And we're trying to understand what happens in the minds of observers as they're watching people stand up for other people in this risky anti-status quo way. So I'm just gonna give a couple of takeaways and then we can dive in. So the first takeaway is that when people witness oppositional courage, it can result in one of two or both outcomes, one being positive and one being negative. One is positive gossip about the actor, which is witnessing this and then going around to your colleagues and saying, I saw what this person did. It was really amazing. This person's so great. This person's someone that we should emulate, etc. And the other is negative gossip, which is sort of the gossip we usually think about, right? Which is like, This person is doing this for selfish reasons, or this person didn't mean it, or I think that their act was not good, etc. So negatively gossiping about the person. So oppositional courage can sort of send people on either of those two paths. That's the first takeaway. The second takeaway is that the reason that it sends them on either of those two paths is because they can either feel morally elevated or morally inferior when they see someone else acting. And I'll talk a little bit more about what that is, but it has to do with how you feel about your own morality in comparison to the person who's standing up. And then the third thing is that there is a way to make sure that people tend to be more elevated when they witness these acts as opposed to more inferior. And that has to do with people's confidence in being able to be courageous themselves.
Got it. Okay, so if I'm just gonna summarize really quick. So oppositional courage, that's you're standing up in a risky situation. And then if you see that, so if I'm watching somebody do this, I'm either going to think, oh, wow, this is great. This person's awesome. And I gossip in a positive way. Or I can say something negative, and it's related to whether I feel inferior from a moral perspective or if I feel elevated from a moral perspective. We'll talk about that more. But I'm going to take a guess that it has to do with, you know, if I feel inferior, that's going to make me feel bad. And so I'm going to have to negatively gossip because now I feel bad about myself, versus more of like the inspiration side that might be happening on the elevation, which will lead to positive gossip because it's like, hey, like I can do this too. And here's a great example of something that I should be trying to do. So I'm really curious to hear more about that, because I think it's and what you can do to make sure that happens, because I think that's really important, because it can be really scary even if you're part of the majority group, to speak up, especially if other people are not speaking up, and if there's, you know, an unpopular opinion or situation. I can just think about, like, in the workplaces that I've been where, you know, maybe there's groups that just don't, for example, see why DEI initiatives are important. And so there's like a whole group of people that are just really kind of not into it, don't see the purpose, and how scary that could be to speak up and say, like, this is why, or this is why we care about it, or I care about it, and trying to get other people on board that maybe are part of a majority group that isn't typically on board. And I've also seen situations where, oh goodness, I just lost it. I had a situation. When it comes back, I will bring it up, because I do think that there are some examples in the work environment of places where people speak up that maybe isn't popular, even though it seems like it should be popular from mm-hmm. our, for me, at least, you and our perspective together, because I think that we see things a little bit differently than maybe some people that haven't experienced these things or thought about these things as much.
Yeah, and something interesting aligned with that is that we controlled for political affiliation. Mm. So it doesn't really have to do with your party line. It has to do more with the way that you witnessing that makes you feel about yourself. And as it turns out, that's a more universal, whether that's why people think they have a negative reaction to these things or not, it does seem like it contributes to people's mm-hmm. negative reactions regardless of how they think about it. The internal response seems to more universally have something to do with, okay, well, I feel bad about me when I see someone doing that, if you're having a negative reaction, even if that's not what you think is happening. So so that part's kind of, we thought, was helpful to sort of splice out. So basically what we did was we gathered some critical incidents. So those are survey question items about times when people had witnessed oppositional courage, to get some examples of the types of things that people had witnessed, as well as kind of how they felt about it after they witnessed that, and what kind of outcomes or things that they did after that. So we gathered some qualitative data to kind of understand, like, how is this playing out in real time? What are the sorts of things that people are seeing folks do? And then we also conducted an experiment where we had people read a story about seeing someone doing this. And then we did a field study where we actually took a look at people seeing this in real time, and we time-lagged it to look at, does witnessing this actually have an impact down the line on the extent to which you're spreading gossip about this person? So just to get into the first takeaway, the first thing around the positive and negative gossip. So it's hard to kind of talk about, and in the paper we don't talk about it separately, but it's kind of hard to talk about the positive and negative gossip without talking about why people are positively and negatively gossiping, this moral piece that's in the middle. So I'll talk about them a little bit together, but just to give some background on what gossip is. We all know what gossip is, I think, colloquially. But this idea of positive gossip is kind of interesting, because we always think of gossip as being negative. But really, positive gossip is just the idea that you're talking about. Gossip is the idea that you're talking about people. And you can have positively valenced gossip, or you can have negatively valenced gossip. And so the reason why people might talk about an act of oppositional courage is because it's the sort of act that stands out to people, and they have to process more carefully because it's not like a normal act. So you can just think about, you're going through your normal workday and something happens that sort of disrupts norms. Those are the sorts of things that people talk about. So the reason that we're talking about gossip here is because these kinds of acts are actually particularly likely to provoke people to talk compared to other types of acts that you might witness in the workplace, because they are not normal.
Yeah, I think, and to your point, I think when you think about how people speak about gossip in just like lay speech, we think it's negative because we're talking about it. We talk about it in a negative way. But ultimately, when someone's saying something positive about somebody to another person, we just wouldn't call that gossip. But really, it is still gossip, right? So that's kind of, I think, where the disconnect is. But to your other point, I do find it really interesting that something this impactful and kind of like different would lead to these behaviors. I mean, it makes sense that it would. But it's such an, I mean, I just like that you guys chose this, because I think it's really an interesting kind of snippet of like what that experience looks like, because we always know, like, if your boss did something weird, you're probably going to talk about it. Like, that doesn't make sense. It's not a social norm, right? Or if a colleague of yours, for example, like, I had a situation where a senior leader like stepped in when I was saying something in like a really positive way and backed me up and supported me, when the other people in the group were not necessarily aligned with this idea, but she saw the vision, and so she just jumped in and like really helped drive the story forward. And like, that's something that stood out to me because of how it was a kind of a unique experience versus, you know, just a normal conversation. Like, the way she backed me up was just really unique, and so then I could talk about that with other people. So I think that there is this really interesting construct here about that unique critical moment that can lead to big change just because it's something out of the norm.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, that's kind of how we ended up on this like gossip kick, was like, okay, what are people likely to do after witnessing this? And one of the things they're likely to do is talk. It's a weird event. It stands out. So they're going to talk. So now we need to figure out, okay, well, if they're going to talk, what's going to promote whether they're going to talk positively or negatively? And one of the reasons why that's important is because if someone does something that stands out from the norm, but it's met with like, oh, wow, that was abnormal in a good way, that can really start to spark and like turn the wheels of social change. Like, oh, someone did something against the norm. That was so cool or interesting, or like, I would like to be like that. As opposed to, someone stood out against the norm, we better like nip this now before more people start doing this. So there's a real implication, I think, for what happens next after these acts happen. Are people more likely to do them themselves later on? Well, it really depends on how people react or respond to them, for other people to learn, like, well, should I do that too, right? So we think that gossip is also like a mechanism towards like whether these behaviors become more contagious. We don't test that here, but it's something in like the future research directions that we think might be cool. So now, like, why do people respond? Why would people respond in either a positive or negative way? As we were talking about, what we suggest is that when someone from your group stands up for something, you see yourself as part of that person's in-group, and so you're more likely to compare yourself to that person, right? So this person is sort of similar to me, so I'm likely to say, okay, well, this person's doing something, how do I compare to that person? And we're constantly making social comparisons. And in the moral domain, when someone does an act that has some moral tone to it, so courageous acts tend to be moral or interpreted as moral in nature because you're sort of acting on a value, right? You're like standing up for something, right? So it says something about the person, if they're standing up for something, that, you know, that their act is imbued with some kind of a value. And so when you're making that comparison, we call this an upward social comparison, which basically is, okay, someone's acting in the moral domain, or at least in a way that they're perceiving as being moral, and I'm standing here watching it. And so my comparison now is, how do I compare to this person who's doing something that has this like sort of moral reverence to it? And what we find is that some observers feel elevated, which is the idea of feeling inspired and uplifted, and other observers feel inferior, which is like, I feel like I lack moral character compared to this person. And that's sort of this feeling of, I think I look worse now than I did before the person did that act, from a moral point of view.
That makes sense. So it's, now I'm comparing, and obviously that's what you're going to tell us leads to the negative gossip, right? As I've compared myself, I don't feel like I'm as good as that person, so how can I bring them down to make myself feel better? It's kind of like, it just makes me think of, you know, when someone makes fun of you at school and you're a kid, and your parents will say something to you like, oh, well, it's not about you, it's about them, right? It's like they're maybe jealous of something. Like, that's the thing that people always say. Someone's jealous. And maybe it's not quite jealousy here, but it's sort of along those lines. It's like, I am not this thing, and therefore I'm going to bring that person down because I feel bad that I'm not this thing, or I didn't do that thing. So I feel like it's something that we can all kind of relate to because of the stories that we hear from our family members when we experience things like bullying or whatever as kids, because it's a very similar idea. And I'm guessing the confidence kind of ties into that as well.
Yeah, so that's right. So I think we are kind of trained of, if someone's mean to you, you need to come up with a reason why they're bad to make yourself feel better. Like, they're, like, just a jealous person or they're, right? So I think it is a similar sense that when I don't feel good about myself, exactly what you said. If I feel bad about myself, there's something satisfying about making the person I feel bad in comparison to look worse, because now I look at least better in comparison than I did before, right? Whereas someone who is morally elevated or uplifted has a very different point of view, which is like, I'm lucky to be in the same organization as this person. I am like this person. And so them acting positively makes me look better because I'm like them and people like me can do what they did. So like, wow, this makes, in our case, like, white people look better. And I'm a white person. So like, I'm uplifted by this. And I feel like you just helped me look better, as opposed to now I look worse compared to you because we're in the same group and you did something that I didn't do. And now you're setting yourself apart from me in a way that makes me feel badly. So those are the two, and you're right that the confidence piece ties in. So we created this new concept called oppositional courage self-efficacy, which is a specific form of self-efficacy. And self-efficacy is just kind of a fancy word for confidence, right? Your confidence in your ability to do something. And what we found was that oppositional courage self-efficacy is actually a form of self-efficacy that is not the same as general self-efficacy. So you can have high confidence in general, but low confidence in yourself in terms of showing oppositional courage. And what we found was that when people were high on oppositional courage self-efficacy, that seemed to provoke these positive feelings of uplift and inspiration, and people positively gossiped. And when people were lower in oppositional courage self-efficacy, they tended to feel worse about themselves. And we thought that that was the case because I feel badly, but there's nothing I think that I can do about it to make that stop. I'm going to say one more thing, but I'll pause there.
Oh, now I'm like waiting for that one more thing. But again, I think this all makes a lot of sense because now you've gotten to this point where you don't feel like you can do anything. The confidence is so important because, again, going back to this childhood story, right? Your mom might say that person's jealous or they don't think they can do that thing, right? Like, there's a piece of that. Like, you're not going to be teased for being really good at math by somebody that also thinks they can be really good at math, right? Your odds are, if it has to do with a confidence issue, it's going to be somebody that feels like they don't have that skill set, that there's a gap for them and that makes them feel bad and so they lash out. So it feels like it's kind of a similar situation, right? Like, here I am feeling like I can't do what that person did. I don't look good because they did that, but I don't think I can do that. I'm scared to do that, whatever the reason is as to why I don't feel like I'm able to do it, I'm gonna now lash out against that person and talk negatively about them because I just can't handle that negative view on myself. No one likes to look in a mirror and see something bad. And I think that is where a lot of our bad behaviors as humans come from.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that makes a lot of sense and plays out in other arenas as well. One thing that's interesting is that people can feel both elevated and inferior at the same time. And in our time lag study for people at higher confidence, it seems like that initial hit that they had where they did feel a little bit bad about themselves, over time they have time to process that and they recognize like, well, oh wait, I could do the same thing, and then they move on. Whereas, you know, people who feel less confident, they have more time to think about how they haven't, they have like more time to stew, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we see these sort of differences coming out where the confidence, even over time, plays a role in how people are responding. But you can feel both at once. It's just like which one sort of breaks stronger, and the confidence has to do with that, which is kind of interesting.
So I have a question about that. If my initial reaction is that kind of inferiority, and then eventually it changes, does that mean I start with negatively gossiping and then change my tune?
We don't know that, because we only measured negative gossip and positive gossip at like one point in time. When we're talking about lags, we're talking only like a couple weeks. So, you know, that's enough time to maybe gossip about a person in between. But it might make you look weird if you start off saying bad stuff and start saying good stuff. And like, kind of what I know about consistency in people, like, you kind of want to like stick with something. So I think more so it's like this like immediate feeling of like, oh, I feel a little bit inferior, but mostly I feel uplifted, or like I feel a little bit uplifted, but mostly I feel inferior. That is kind of like breaking people in one direction or another that has to do with the confidence.
Okay, so it's basically which one am I more of that wins and how I'm going to speak about the person. But it's normal to kind of have both reactions, which makes sense, right? Like, this is like a silly example, but somebody that wants to get engaged and they see their friend get engaged, right? You're super excited for your friend, but then you have like a moment where you're sad too. But you can have both of those feelings at the same time. Be really excited for one person and sad for yourself. So it kind of feels like that is what's happening here from in some of these situations.
Yeah, I think that's right. Like, and you probably, if you felt that little bit of like sadness, but mostly happy, you wouldn't be like, oh, well, like they shouldn't be blah, blah. But if you felt like mostly like upset and only a little bit happy, you might be like, well, you know, they're not as good as blah, blah. You know, like that's when like negative gossip can come out, because like the predominant thing you're feeling is, is that. Other thing that I think is important just to add from like a practical takeaway standpoint, because confidence is so important in this equation, the good news is that there is a lot of research that shows that you can grow your confidence through training, and that trainings that help people to understand how to stand up for things, what the different ways are that you can do that, trainings that encourage people to stand up when they see things that are, you know, going wrong, or to try to change a norm in an organization, all of those sorts of things can help people to like grow their confidence in themselves, that if they see something, they can do something. And we don't have evidence in our study that a training would turn this off, but we think that because other forms of self-efficacy can be trained in more skill-specific domains, that this should be no different. So our big take-home is that if you want courage to be contagious in your organization, and you don't want people to talk badly about people who are trying to stand up for things when they see them or change norms that might be negative, that offering some kind of training about how to be courageous and stand up for what's right can help.
I like that. I think it's a pretty easy solution, and I think there's a lot of really interesting ways you can do that type of training. So I'm thinking like role playing is probably really important, providing scenarios and having people like step up even without like giving them true guidelines of like what to say. Like you can do some of those types of role plays with like actual like scripts, and then you can do role plays where it's like, all right, well now we're in this situation, what do? And have people practice that. And you do that in small groups, so you get people like really excited and trusting each other and having these conversations. And then those types of trainings typically lead to people talking about it after the training. And that's like obviously where we know that's where the pull through is. Like we need people to continue to have these conversations after the fact. So it's not like I sat in this training one day and then I'm done and great. Like I might think about it for 2 weeks, but then I'm going to forget about it in 6 months from now, so it doesn't actually change anything. So now it's like, how do you continue that pull through? To get people to think about this consistently. And after you've done it for a few months, or like see other people be doing it for a few months, then you can all get into this practice. And I can see that confidence just kind of growing collectively as well. So I think that I have like so many ideas of like fun ways to train this that I think would be really cool.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And I think and some of those suggestions about role playing and things like that, we put in the article as well, concrete ways that you can really get people to feel like, okay, I can do this because I've done this before. And I also think in the gossip research, not necessarily here because we didn't test that, but like in the gossip research, powerful people and their opinions and what they have to say about people carry more weight than others. So if you're gonna start with training somebody, it should be the most, your like organizational social influencers, right? So that if someone stands up for something, if you have a norm, and this could be true of a lot of things, if you have a norm for bullying in your organization, for example, and someone stands up against that norm, and a really powerful person backs them instead of speaking negatively about them, that can do a lot to turn the norm around, as opposed to, you know, if the person's like talking about how that person's like lame or something. Mm-hmm. So if you're gonna train certain people, your social influencers are important.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I mean, it kind of gets back to the example I gave of that leader that backed me up, right? It's like the conversation could have gone multiple directions,
but because she supported me and backed me up, it really did change the mood and the trajectory of the project we're working on. Just because she was a senior leader, person of power, a lot of respect in the room. So I think that makes a lot of sense, like really focusing on that population, getting them the skill set so that it can continue to trickle down and grow within the organization more holistically, and create like a new system, basically totally different norms. But this is great. I'm so glad I got to do an article of yours.
Yeah, me too. And thanks so much for listening to it. Hope folks out there learn something a little bit about how to make courage more catchy. And yeah, just thanks for entertaining my stuff.
Well, we love your work and cannot wait to see what else comes of all this work that you're doing. I'm sure there's going to be more follow-ups and fun things to come. So we'll be hanging tight. And thank you for all of our listeners for joining us, listening in. And again, if you want to get updates from us about our book, please sign up for our email list in the show notes. Thanks for listening.
Thriving at Work, a Worker Being podcast, is hosted by us, Dr. Patricia Grabarek and Dr. Katina Sawyer, and produced by Allie Johnson.